This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Both professional sports and sports media have long been dominated by men. And while there have been strides for women, professional sports leagues for the athletes, and access to the locker rooms where key post-game interviews happen for the journalists, problems persist. Today, women in sports and sports media are still navigating an industry built by and for men. Whether it's on the field or in the broadcasting booth, women are still dealing with sexism, double standards, rampant harassment, unequal pay, and a culture that breeds and protects violence of both the domestic and sexual kind. Joining us to talk more about this is Julie DeCaro. You may know her from her previous work as a host on the Chicago sports radio station, WSCR-AM, better known as 670 The Score. She was also featured in the 2016 Peabody Award-winning viral video, More Than Mean, about online harassment of women in sports media. DeCaro is now a senior writer and editor at Deadspin, and her new book, out this week, is called Sidelined: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America. Julie DeCaro, thanks so much for joining us today on The 21st.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, we want to invite you into our conversation. Our lines are open at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455, especially if you're a woman. What have been your experiences in the world of sports? Or maybe what have you witnessed? What do you think needs to change? Or call us with any other comments or questions you might have for our guest, Julie DeCaro, as it relates to women in sport. The number again, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So, Julie, in the book's opening passages, you write, "I wrote this book because of all the things I felt I couldn't say working in sports media, and all the times other women have whispered things to me, important things, and sworn me to secrecy." We're going to get into the details of that later, but was there a moment when that went from something building up in the back of your mind to, "I have to write this book"?
You know, it really didn't. Normally I just sort of scream into the void on Twitter. And I think that while all writers sort of imagine themselves writing a book one day, I didn't really have a concrete plan for it. Actually, a publisher reached out to me from a small publishing house and said, "You know, you have a lot of great thoughts, and I think you should put them in a book. And there probably needs to be a book out there that you've written." And that was the first time I really thought about writing nonfiction about sort of what I myself and other women are going through. Otherwise, I think I probably would still just be yelling about it on social media and not have, you know, condensed it into some kind of organized fashion for people to read. But because of that, I wound up getting an agent, wound up finding a different publisher, and that was sort of the genesis of the book. But, you know, it's interesting because I think it sort of goes along with this, one of the things we talk about in the book, which is that you have to be able to see it to be it. And that representation matters. And how many women out there have written books about sports? Not as many as we see from men. So yeah. It was one of those things that I didn't really think about until someone else put the idea in my head.
And you said you started with a small publisher. You ended up with quite a big one. Penguin Random House is one of the biggest out there.
I did. So. Well, the guy who wanted it initially didn't want the book once we put the proposal together. So, it worked out great for me, but I felt kind of bad.
All right. Your path into sports media had some interesting turns. You were a lawyer for a number of years before transitioning to sports talk radio. Can you talk about that journey?
Yeah, I think it goes back to representation. I always wanted to do play-by-play for the Cubs. That was what I wanted to do as a kid growing up. I practiced in front of the TV, practiced in my head, laying in bed at night. I went to journalism school at Indiana University. And, when I graduated, there really wasn't a path for women to go into sports media, really. It was, you know, a couple guys who had an uncle at Sports Illustrated who got him an internship. Otherwise, you were looking at going to a really small town paper and fighting to be able to cover what you wanted to cover. And that wasn't that appealing to me. So I went to law school and I was a lawyer. And then when blogs started popping up and sports blogs started popping up, I got involved pretty early on and was able to do my own sports, my own Cubs blog, which then got picked up by the Chicago Tribune. And then when, you know, I wound up working for the Tribune, and then when they decided that WGN was going to do an FM sports talk radio station, they reached out and asked me to come be on the station. So it was funny because it was many, many years after I initially wanted to go into the industry that I wound up there.
You're right that you went into radio feeling like the luckiest woman on the planet and left feeling disillusioned and sad. I mean, can you maybe talk a little bit about what you encountered when you landed in, you know, something that was at least on the path to what you say was your dream job as a kid.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because practicing law, I had never been the only woman in a room. I'd never been made to feel like I didn't belong somewhere. That's not to say that there isn't sexism and people don't condescend to you when you're a young woman lawyer and things like that. But I didn't feel it the way that I felt it in sports talk radio, where you're just sort of, I mean, first of all, going into a place where I would be there for, you know, 5-6 hours and not see a woman the entire time I was there, unless I ran into someone in the bathroom, was completely new for me. Huh. And I think, you know, it was the first time that I sort of felt boxed in, like I wasn't being considered for positions that I wanted. I don't think they could have conceived of putting a woman in those positions at the time. And so, you know, and the other thing too, is that you are often, and I know a lot of women have said this to me, that you are left out of the whisper network of who's coming and going, what jobs are opening, who's up for what job. I mean, and how do you, so I would hear about someone leaving and their replacement would be announced at the same time. How do you even let people know you want that job or you're interested in that job if you don't even know it's coming open? And that's just sort of one of the things that women face in this industry across the board, which is really one of the last remaining, I think, vestiges of a truly male dominated workspace.
Yeah, the old boys club kind of thing that's been broken in other places. You know, you also mentioned that people kind of encourage you to adopt this lucky to be here mentality, right? Can you talk about what that's like and you know, whether it's more harmful than good and how you escape that?
Yeah, you know, it's true. I mean, whenever I would complain about not getting, because I started off as an update anchor. And so whenever I would say, you know, I want a chance to host during the day, I want a chance to host late at night, I want to fill in for somebody, you know, because I wasn't happy just being an update anchor. It was never what I wanted to do. It was just sort of one of those put your time in things. But when I would feel like I wasn't getting the opportunities to move up, I would talk about it to my colleagues and was sort of told over and over, oh, you know, a million women would love to have your job. And I think we look at how few of us there are in the industry compared to how many men there are. And we really do feel like, wow, I am lucky. There are hardly any women working in this industry and I'm one of them. So it serves to keep you complacent and not to ask for what you want and not to speak up and not to fight for things because you feel like your position is so tenuous. I'm just lucky to have this job in the first place. And I think that's a trap that a lot of women fall into. So you wind up, you know, not going forward to your boss and asking for what you want, not saying, you know, I want to be a host and hopefully within 2 years, I want to be hosting my own show. What do I need to do to get there? Because we're just sort of taught to accept the scraps and be happy with what we have because so many other women have tried to make it in this industry and have failed. And it really does serve to sort of keep us in those part-time, late-night roles.
And you say that even when you got a hosting gig, right, you are still paid hourly. You suspect that a number of your male colleagues have more sort of lucrative contracts. Can you talk about that pay disparity? I mean, this also comes in the context of this is throughout sport because we've seen the women's soccer team, WNBA players also fighting for equal pay for equal work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not even just limited to sports. I mean, the equal wages is a battle that we're waging around the world for women, right? So that was the whole idea behind the book was that, you know, we use sports as the entree in to talk about these issues that are affecting women everywhere. But yeah, I mean, I was always told, you know, I never moved past part-time, even though I had my own show that was on every night, even though I also had a weekend show. I never was able to move past part-time. I was still paid $25 an hour and other guys, and my show was on for 2 hours a night. So, I mean, you can do the math. Other guys, you know, who host during the daytime and host bigger shows. I mean, they all have agents and they're negotiating contracts. And whenever I would bring that up, I was just sort of told, well, there's no money. Meanwhile, you know, they'd bring in more men and give them these huge contracts. And so, you know, it's one of those things that I think just sort of serves to demoralize those of us that get stuck in those positions.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with sports journalist Julie DeCaro. You might know her from her previous work hosting a show on the AM radio station, The Score, in Chicago. She was also an anchor for a sports update anchor for WGN Radio. She's now a senior writer and editor at Deadspin. Her new book out this week is called Sidelined: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America. Our lines are open. We're taking your calls at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We want to know, what have been your experiences as a woman in the world of sports? What did you, maybe you were just an athlete growing up, what did you experience? Or maybe you've witnessed things. What needs to change? 800-222-9455 is the number. I want to sort of zoom out for a minute now, and because the book, it not only talks about some of these issues we've been talking about, but to put these issues in context, let's talk about the role of sports as a means of empowerment for women. This is a chapter in your book. What did sports mean to you growing up? And how do you think it can be a force to elevate the lives of girls and women around the world?
Yeah, I grew up in Northern Illinois, in a small town where everybody was an athlete, it seemed like. And we all played multiple sports, girls and boys, together growing up. And, you know, I started off, I didn't play on a women's soccer team until I was in high school. Before that, I played with the boys. We all did. And I, you know, there's a generation that has been born since Title IX was enacted in 1972. And sports has been every bit as central to our lives as it has been to our brothers and our dads and our uncles. And, you know, first of all, it's strange, this idea that women aren't involved in sports for whatever reason. So that is weird in and of itself. And then, you know, the other thing is that if you see what a world looks like without women in sports, like I did in Pakistan, it is, you don't realize the ways that sports, the things it teaches you off the field, right? How to use your voice, how to work with as a team, how to ask for what you want, how to be aggressive, how to be competitive, and to normalize those behaviors for women, which are very normal. Those are not behaviors and attitudes that are endemic to men. So I go to Pakistan and you really see what a world looks like without Title IX, where there are not sports for the girls to play in school, and that you're meeting girls who are in their teenage years or, you know, in their preteen years, who have never run, who have never chased a ball, who have never, you know, done any kind of that athletic thing because it's been deemed not acceptable for them. And, you know, we saw a real difference in, I went with a program that was, you know, was using sports as development. So bringing girls into sports and teach them not only about sports, but about what to do, you know, how to open a bank account, how to manage your money, what to do if you're in a situation with domestic violence, what to do if you get raped, all these kinds of things that we sort of take for granted in this country. And, you know, there was a real difference between the girls that were playing at a younger age. They were much louder. They were much more forward. They had much more confidence than a lot of the girls we saw who started playing sports when they were older. And so it was the first time I think it really hit me that, you know, I say it in the book all the time, like sports isn't just about sports. Sports is about society. And we've worked through so many issues in our society through sports, whether we're talking about Jackie Robinson integrating baseball before America was integrated, Muhammad Ali with the Vietnam War, Billie Jean King with gender equality and with LGBTQ rights. So you sort of take for granted how sports helps us work through those issues until you see a place where that's really not the case. And it's a wonderful thing to see because, you know, in Pakistan, there's a real movement towards women's rights and equality. And sports is a big part of teaching young girls to talk out and to use their voices.
You know, we've got about 3 minutes until we need to take a break, but you know, one of the societal issues, you said we use sports as a way of working out these societal issues. One of the ways in which we've seen that manifest, and maybe we've seen our failure to deal with an issue, is in the chapter of your book. You write about this. The chapter is called Believe Women, right? And you explore sports' broken relationship with domestic violence. And, you know, it's pretty eye-opening, the list of players in this chapter. Some of the younger producer on our show was not even familiar with some of the allegations against people like Kobe Bryant and Patrick Kane going way back a couple of decades in some cases. There are so many instances of male athletes accused of or admitting to domestic and sexual violence, and yet they land on their feet. In some cases, their careers continue to blossom. What does this say about the values of the world of sports?
Oh, wow. Well, it says a lot. I mean, I think that, you know, not just in the idea that, you know, men can, you know, in Kobe Bryant's case, he basically confessed in a letter that he wrote to the victim that was made public, a public apology to her. And it's just sort of, okay, we're done with that now. And one of the real issues that we have when this stuff happens is that, and we're seeing it now with Deshaun Watson, you know, being accused, I think there's six women now accusing him of sexual assault. You're not allowed to talk about it at the time because it's too soon and we don't know all the facts. And then once the victim is sort of harassed into going away or there's a private settlement, now it's in the past and you're not allowed to talk about it. And then heaven forbid you bring it up down the road in the future and then you get, why are you trying to destroy this man's life? That was ages ago. So there's never a time when it's appropriate for us to talk about this stuff. And, you know, the NFL doesn't want us to talk about it. The NHL doesn't want us to talk about it. They want people to feel good when they're watching sports. And there's a lot of people out there who just want to feel good when they're watching sports and they don't want to think about this stuff. But if you're a woman, if you're a person of color, if you're Black, if you are a member of the LGBTQ community, if you, you know, practice Islam, like you see the discrimination against you and the violence against you coming from athletes all the time. And it's difficult to forget. You can't just, I mean, I can't just turn on the NFL and see a couple guys out there accused of, like watching the Kansas City Chiefs, there's two or three guys on that team that have been accused of either sexual assault or domestic violence. I can't forget that when I watch. But the loudest voices in the room are the people who do want to forget that. And they shout down the people who keep bringing the topic up. We saw that after Kobe Bryant died. We've seen it with Ben Roethlisberger. We've seen it with Gabe Kapler, who was hired to manage the San Francisco Giants. You're just not allowed to talk about that stuff. And if you do, you will get harassed into shutting up. You know, it's a real problem.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation. My guest is Julie DeCaro. Her book is Sidelined: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America. It's out this week. You can join our conversation. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. More with Julie DeCaro after a short break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking the rest of this hour with sports journalist Julie DeCaro. She's an editor at Deadspin. You might previously know her from hosting a show on The Score, the AM sports radio station in Chicago. She is also the author of a new book out this week. It's called Sidelined: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America. If you want to join our conversation, 800-222-9455, especially if you have been a woman in the world of sports, what have you experienced? What have you witnessed? What needs to change? 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. Julie, early in the book, you talk about the history of some of the issues that women have faced in sports media. Let's focus on this question of locker room access. There was a fight starting in the 70s, even after women won the right, often in court, to go into locker rooms where, if people aren't familiar, this is where the sort of key post-game interviews happen. Can you talk about what it was like for women before they got that access and what it was like after they got the legal access, but maybe were not still welcome?
Yeah. So, you know, Leslie Visser was just telling me the other day that her first press pass said not valid if held by a woman or a child. And I always think of that, like, that's just kind of amazing. Leslie Visser. I mean, So, yeah, I mean, back in the 70s, women, whether or not they got to go in the locker room sort of depended on the sport, sort of depended on the coach, sort of depended on the day. So there were women that had been in the locker rooms. I think the first time women went in any locker room was in the early 70s in an NHL All-Star game. And because there was sort of no one really in charge of the team, they just went in at this Robin St. Herman, and I can't remember who the other person was, but they just walked in, and that was it. In sports like baseball, it was much tougher. And Melissa Ludke and Claire Smith have wonderful stories about, well, not wonderful, but I mean, they're colorful stories about, yes, what it was like trying to get in the locker room. You know, Melissa Ludke was sort of painted by, you know, other newspapers in New York as this wanton woman who wanted to be in the locker room to see naked guys. Claire Smith has this heartbreaking story about standing outside the locker room and during the World Series and crying because everybody went in except her. She's the only woman with a beat at the time. She's supposed to be covering the World Series and she can't get in the locker room. And so Steve Garvey comes out and says, you know, I'll stand here as long as you want me to. I'll answer all your questions, but you have to stop crying. And that was sort of what it was for women. I mean, they had to stand outside while all the men went in and did their jobs and got all the great quotes and got all the information they needed. And the women had to stand outside and request that a player come out. And, you know, by that time, the players already answered the questions a million times. Any back and forth that's happened, say, between Reggie Jackson and Billy Martin in the World Series has already taken place. And now, you know, you have a player. Melissa talks about Reggie Jackson coming out the night that he hit 3 home runs in the World Series and saying, you know, I'm sorry, I'm exhausted, I'm going home. So she didn't get an interview. So Melissa sued Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner of baseball, in 1976 and got to go in. And then I think everyone else sort of saw the writing on the wall. But, you know, just a couple of years ago, we had a female writer kept out of a locker room in Indianapolis because the usher who was guarding the locker room didn't think that she belonged in there. And then that's not to mention, like you suggested, that once women got in the locker room, that there weren't bad things happening in there to them. And there still are. I mean, you know, they talk about having jock straps thrown at them and having guys dump a bucket of ice water on their head or guys pulling them onto their laps all the time. And, you know, there's still, I think people would be surprised to know the names of some of the athletes who sort of have a reputation for the way they behave in locker rooms towards women. Some of them are very much beloved NFL players, but it's a weird place to interview people. Nobody wants to be in the locker room.
Yeah, this is what I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is such a, you know, this is a question that you raise that's sort of like, once you ask it, you think like, yeah, of course. Like, people don't, in the Senate, when you're interviewing Senator Dick Durbin, you don't have to follow him into the men's room of the Senate to get the interview. Why are we still doing these interviews in the locker room?
Yeah. It's bizarre. And the women will say, like, I didn't want to go in the locker room. I just wanted to go where everything was happening. And that just happened to be in the locker room. It's, you know, pro sports that have decided the locker room is the place to be. So, yeah, it's gross. Nobody wants to be in there. Certainly not to see naked men. But that's sort of been the story. And you still hear that all the time. Like, oh, I bet you just got into sports because guys are cute and you want to see them in the locker room. And, you know, anyone who's been in a locker room will tell you nobody wants to be in there.
Yeah. And you write, I mean, so as much as those women, the early pioneers of this field, had to face, I want to talk about, you know, they didn't at least have Twitter on, you know, where people could just harass them personally and directly every hour of every day. And one of the chapters in your book explores this online harassment. And you were also part of, people might be remember the hashtag More Than Mean video a few years ago. I'm just going to read briefly a summation from the Peabody Award that it won. More Than Mean takes a common device from late night television, the reading of mean tweets, and uses it to expose the angry, hateful bile that female sportscasters are subject to simply for doing their jobs. A moving attack on misogynistic troll culture, the video's simple message about civility online is painfully conveyed by the damage the vicious tweets do not only to the women forced to hear them, but also to the unsuspecting men who read them face to face with the female reporters and who are literally confronted with the immediacy of violence and sexism. I got to say, Julie, when I was watching this video, I was reminded of the, is it the Milgram experiments where they had people think that they were shocking someone in the other room, and you're watching the video and you're thinking, please stop pressing the shock button. Yeah. And I kept thinking, please stop reading these tweets. And then I think the difference here is you were actually being shocked in the room, right? You're actually in the Milgram experience. No one was experiencing that. Can you talk about, I mean, you deal with this harassment every day, what that's like, but also, you know, the experience of making that video in particular.
So the video, you know, everything good that has happened to me in my life has been because I just randomly said yes to something where I had no idea what I was getting into. And that's exactly what happened here. I'd had a really bad day. I'd previously written a piece for Sports Illustrated about online harassment in sports media. And the guys whose idea it was to have the video reached out to me via cold email and just said, you know, we're going to do this. And I had such a bad day online. I was like, yeah, sure. Let's do it. Why not? Next thing I know, it's a couple weeks later, I'm standing in a warehouse in Ukrainian village with a bunch of guys I don't know, but they had a very clear picture of what they wanted this to look like. And so all credit goes to the guys who came up with this idea. What was it like making it? You know, the day that it launched, I was homesick from work. I'd taken a nap. Didn't even know it was going to necessarily go up that day. And I woke up and I had something like 300 notifications on my phone.
Oh my God.
From people that had seen it. My parents found out about it because they saw it on CBS Evening News. So it definitely took off and it was kind of a whirlwind for us. And, you know, and I think the reason that it resonated with so many people is that I think if it had just been Sarah and I getting upset at what they were saying to us, it wouldn't have hit the way it did. I think what upset people were seeing men being upset, because everywhere that we went, we had so many people ask us, did you ever tell the guys it was okay? Like, are they okay? Like, did you apologize for what you did to them? Because they're sort of unsuspecting, right? And they're watching these tweets getting darker and darker as they're going. And it seems like it was the men's discomfort that is what really resonated with people. And I've always found that interesting.
Yeah, and we obviously can't repeat the words on the radio here that are used, you know, in some of the tweets that are read out, but they get more and more vulgar and vicious and violent as it goes on. Can you talk about some of the harassment that you faced as a woman in sports media?
Well, just yesterday, the day after my book came out, the guys at Barstool Sports read the entire book online on a YouTube channel. Because they think it's funny and they wanted to make fun of it. So for 7.5 hours, they read my entire book. You know,
never mind copyright or anything like that.
Right. So, you know, the weird thing about it is you never know when it's going to come, when it's going to hit. I mean, there certainly have been times when I've braced myself for backlash because of something I said. And there's other times when it just completely come out of the blue. And those are the worst times because you can't emotionally steel yourself for the storm if you don't know the storm is coming. You know, it's strange. It's sort of a day-to-day thing. People always ask me how I handle it. And I don't necessarily think I handle it all that well. I have good days and bad days. It's one of those things that no one should have to wade through this stuff to do their job. And the worst part about it, I think, you know, once you get past people, you know, threatening to kill you and stuff, you develop a thicker skin towards that. But the thing that I think is the most harmful is that women self-censor because you just don't want to deal with the blowback. So when we're talking about issues of domestic violence or sexual assault in sports, or when we're talking about, you know, Black Lives Matter, or Colin Kaepernick, there are days when I really feel like we need women's voices and we need the voices of Black women in particular, women of color. And you just don't say anything because you're like, you know what, I just can't deal with it today. I have something I feel like I should say. I want to add my voice, but today I just can't handle it. I'm too stressed out. I'm too, you know, whatever. So then you find people limiting their voices at a time when we really need to hear in this space for more women, and particularly Black women and women of color. But because no one is policing the backlash, there's simply no way to handle it sometimes. And so, like I said, it leads to self-censorship in an area where women are already a very small percentage of the voices.
Just a few minutes left in our conversation. You dedicate a chapter in the book to solidarity and the need for women to work together. You also write that when you were laid off early in the pandemic from the radio station, it was a woman who let you go. You use the phrase cool girl to describe women who don't support other women. Can you talk more about that term and that concept generally?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pressure on women to be in sports media, especially to be the cool girl. And I think we sort of all go through this phase maybe in your 20s, maybe in your 30s even, where it's sort of like, oh, I get along with men better than women. I don't get along with women because they're so dramatic. I like guys much better. You know, and the cool girl lets the sexist jokes go and laughs along with them. And the cool girl never rocks the boat. Cool girl never says, you know, you can't say that in front of me. That's not okay. The cool girl is, you know, what guys sort of want women to be, sort of hot, cute, funny, and most of all, complacent. And I think a lot of us go through that phase. I know I did. And I know other women have told me that they went through it as well. And, you know, especially in sports media where there are so few women, why do you want to have a woman? If you're a guy who wants to have a workplace where he can do and say whatever he wants, why do you want to have a woman there who's going to rock the boat and who's going to go to HR and say, hey, this is not okay. This is what's happening. So, you know, I think that's how women get labeled difficult when in reality, what they're doing is just standing up for themselves. And, you know, one of the things that I tell young women when I'm speaking with them is, you know, when you inevitably either slam into a glass ceiling or get sexually harassed at work or get harassed online by fans, it's going to be your women colleagues. They're the ones that are going to pick you up, dust you off, and sort of push you back in the direction that you came from. And that has been my experience. I know that's been the experience of a lot of other women in this industry that, you know, men or male colleagues may have the best intentions in the world, but when the chips are really down, it's the other women that are there for you. And that is something that it took me quite a while to learn because there are so few women in this industry. We all look at each other as competition and we need to stop doing that. And we need to be lifting each other up and sort of lifting as we climb.
You know, there's so much in the book that we haven't had time to get to. I do want to, you know, just briefly, I mean, you go into the U.S. Open match where Serena Williams argues with an official and is criticized for being unladylike. Meanwhile, yeah. A generation of men tennis players break tennis rackets and they're just, oh, boys will be boys. Yeah. We don't have time to get into all that. I want to end by asking you in about a minute, if you can, what you want to see from your male colleagues in sports. What needs in sports media, I should say, what needs to be done to change this?
You know, a lot of times I hear guys say, you know, she doesn't need me to fight her battles for her. She's a big girl. She's strong. She's tough, you know. But sometimes we do need allies to stand next to us while we fight. So, you know, I would have a lot of guys say to me, oh, that is so wrong. You should go talk to HR. You should complain about this. You should let this person know. Very few said, I'll go with you and I will stand there with you while you do this. Let's go together. And I think that is a big thing that we need. And like I said before, the Whisper Network as well, women need to be part of that. And I did have a couple guys who were always making sure that I knew what was going on. And I'm very grateful for that because otherwise I would have been completely left out. So, you know, forget about the guys who call you a white knight or say that you're, you know, riding to the rescue. Like sometimes we all need to be rescued no matter what gender you are. So, you know, treat women the way you would want to be treated and offer to stand up for them. That's something that I think we don't get enough.
Julie DeCaro, I want to thank you so much for being with me today on the 21st and for sharing some of these at times very harrowing experiences from your life, both here and in the book.
Thanks for having me.
Julie DeCaro is an editor at Deadspin. Her new book out this week is called Sidelined: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America. And that is all the time we have for our show today. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Chantel Vaca is our engagement producer. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. You can get a podcast of our program. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. You can also find links at our website and past segments. All that's at 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk to you again next week.